This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
It's hard not to add a side of hot, crispy hash browns to your favorite McDonald's breakfast. It's even harder not to eat said hash browns before you get home. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At the UPS store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
Hello, and welcome back to the Science Focus podcast. I'm Dan Bennett, the editor of BBC Science Focus magazine. This is part two of everything you wanted to know about illusions, magic, and the paranormal with Professor Richard Wiseman. If you missed part one, head back now and find out why scientists study magic and illusions, why we enjoy being deceived, and what happens when we experience the impossible. In this episode, Richard and I discuss how you can make your own luck, what he found out when he studied one of the most haunted places in the UK, and what this all has to do with the moon landings. Okay, so... You wrote a book all about luck and indeed studied it for many years. So it would be remiss if I didn't ask you, could I be born lucky? Or can I, which I think I am, by the way. My mum tells me I was born on the 4th, which is a very lucky day, apparently. And if I thought I was born unlucky, would I be able to make my own luck?
They're good questions and not unrelated to magic because lots of people have a very magical view of luck. So that work dates back quite a while now, and it came from me interviewing people about key moments in their lives, and they'd often say, oh, I'm a lucky person, or, you know, my partner is extremely unlucky or whatever. At that point, no one had done any research into luck. They'd sort of dismissed it as kind of superstitious nonsense or just chance. And so I started to look at the psychology of it. We worked with about 1,000 exceptionally lucky and unlucky people. And we could see that for the most part, not true of everyone all the time, but for the most part, people were making their own luck by the way they were thinking and behaving. And so to them, it did look like magic in their lives, that they would always get loads of opportunities or, you know, always fall on their feet or whatever. But we could see that lucky people were creating those opportunities. They are very well connected with others. They are very resilient. When bad things happen, they would bounce back. They're very optimistic. And so their optimism would become a self-fulfilling prophecy, and the opposite with unlucky people. And then we did a series of experiments known as Luck School, where we got people to think and behave differently. And yes, you see changes to their self-perceived luck. So what you can do is change how lucky people feel, and that has a big impact on their lives. What it will have no impact on at all is them going to the casino or buying a lottery ticket. That's chance. And there's, you know, you can't be great if you could, but you can't get people to be more likely to win the lottery except by buying more tickets. Even then, the gain's quite marginal. But you can get them to be luckier in life. And so that was my focus there.
And so just to dig into that a little more, so you took people who, you know, felt like their whole life they had been unlucky, and you took your learnings from looking at these two groups of lucky and unlucky people, and you taught the unlucky ones how to, you know, make their own luck in the world.
That's right.
And can you talk a little bit about how what were the things you were teaching them?
Well, I think, again, it comes down to assumptions. Once you start to see the world in a certain way, you assume that those assumptions, that worldview, is somehow the truth. So a scenario that we'd give them would be something like, imagine you're standing in a bank, in bursts a robber, they've got a gun, they fire a shot, and the bullet hits you in the arm. Are you lucky or unlucky? Now, the unlucky people would just look astounded. And they just go, I've just been shot in the arm. Of course I'm unlucky. Why? What is the point of this experiment? The lucky people would go, my goodness, another lucky day. You know, that bullet could have hit my head, could have hit my heart. You know, if it's a big raid, then maybe the media are covering it. I'll sell my story. I'll make some money, and so on. So when you point out to the unlucky people, there's another way of looking at that. If instead of every event that happens to you, you think, well, it could have been better, which is what unlucky people do, that bullet could have missed me altogether. If instead you generate counterfactuals, as they're known in psychology, counterfactuals, which are, it could have been worse, you change your mindset. But until you point that out, it never occurs to people because they think, well, this is how the world is. I'm an unlucky person and that's that. So it's kind of common sense, but like the old adage goes, common sense often isn't very common. And often you do have to point it out. Then once people use that technique of generating those counterfactuals, they become more resilient. And therefore people want to be around them. Now they're a little bit better connected. Now opportunities start to come their way. So change isn't difficult if it's the right type of change based on good scientific evidence.
And this is something that struck me actually when I first read about some of your work in this area, particularly, you know, the example you just talked about with the bank robbery, and how we are able to sort of frame our own experiences, I suppose. It did make me wonder the question, why, and I'm probably going to ask you this question again later as well, why or should we be teaching this kind of stuff in school?
So I'm quite passionate about this. I've spoken about this many times. We absolutely should. So we teach kids, you know, maths and English, all these things. And of course we should be doing that. And then we let them out into the world with often very poor life skills, the sorts of things that psychologists know about, particularly in an area called positive psychology, about how you become happy, how you retain that happiness, how you use optimism. I mean, right at the moment, you know, understanding how to remain optimistic is really important. And people think, oh, it's just positive thinking. You know, just cheer up. Just expect tomorrow to be better. And you think, none of that is true. You know, you need to have global hope at the moment. But if tomorrow's going to be another rough day, you don't want to be thinking it's going to be a better day and that's a disappointment. And the day after that's a disappointment and so on. And so there's a huge difference between what's called global optimism and day-to-day optimism. People need to know this stuff. It's really important. And for some reason, we leave it to the self-help books for the most part to tell us. A lot of that stuff isn't scientific. It's just some practitioner going, oh, this seems to work, or try that. And it seems to a crazy state of affairs to me. So I would love to see psychology, that type of some practical psychology, taught in schools, yeah.
And certainly, as you said, in the state we find ourselves in now, it could be, you know, quite powerful giving people the tools to kind of at least understand their own thoughts and their own mind to a better detail.
That's right. And understanding about anxiety and how you deal with that. And also how you... So the one thing that I think we are astonishing at, and this gets back to some of our earlier discussions, is change. We are phenomenal at adapting to change. And so that's why I have hope about the current situation. I think the world that emerges may well be very different. But I've hope that it will be possibly a better world. We are very, very good at changing. We have very, very plastic brains in that sense. We learn. And that should give us enormous hope for the future. And again, it's something we should tell kids. You know, I hate this idea of you're this type of person or that type of person, or that you're good at maths or you're not good at maths. You know, it's crazy. All this stuff that's around growth mindset at the moment is wonderful. Just this telling kids you change. You might not like maths at the moment, but maybe you will in a couple of years' time. We change, we learn. That's what makes life interesting.
Yeah, you're right. I hadn't thought of it in that kind of window of we do seem to have a habit of setting kids in stone at a very young point in their life.
Absolutely. And it gets back to magic. It's about putting people in boxes and putting ourselves in boxes. And what magicians do is they come along and go, you know, all those assumptions, they're just assumptions. They're not true. And that you have great potential. So I think that's those are the sorts of messages I like to hear.
Okay. So I'm going to go back just a little to something you just mentioned, just to clarify, because I think luck did seem quite popular on Google. I wonder why. and that's you touched on it. So I can't you know take the teachings from your research and go out into a casino. I can't make my odds any better.
Well, you can definitely try, and let me know how it goes. But they're nice buildings. Normally they're quite plush buildings.
Are they?
Well, if you go to Vegas, they're very nice, and some of them. And they're not built on what they're earning from the winners, put it like that. if you go to casino, then the odds obviously are against you. That's how the whole system works. And no matter how optimistic and positive you are, it won't make any difference at all. In fact, it may be against you because you get this gambler's fallacy where you lose the money and think, well, then I'm going to win, big next time and so on. So, no, I think avoiding those and focusing on luck in life is probably a better way forward.
Okay. So I'm going to move on to another area of study that you've, spent a fair amount of time in, especially there in where you are in Edinburgh. You study seances. Again, you might ask, why are you studying seances as a scientist? What's that all about?
Perfectly reasonable question. So I studied the paranormal actually for a long time. So the Kirstler Chair of Parapsychology at Edinburgh University. And I was always very sceptical about it. Most magicians are quite sceptical about such matters. But I was interested in how psychics and mediums persuade us they're in touch with the dead or whatever. And that's a whole different type of deception. It's all quite fascinating. But then I read about Victorian darkroom seances, where in Victorian times, before television, when it was all a lot more interesting in the evenings, they would make the room very dark. They'd have luminous dots on objects. You place those in the middle of the table. They'd hold hands. Often there'd be a medium present, and these objects would fly around the room. And there is a whole genre in magic about how to do those tricks. So I looked up all of that stuff, and I looked at it and thought, really? I mean, really? That's going to fool anyone? Because the techniques are very simple. And I just didn't believe it. So I thought, let's stage my own experimental seances, because if it fools us nowadays, it probably would have fooled us in Victorian times. So we used traditional techniques to fool modern day audiences. And people walked out not having any clue how we did it. So these techniques absolutely work in the emotionally charged atmosphere of the seance room. The darkness helps as well. Often people want to believe that the spirit world still exists, and that helps you as a performer. So it was kind of fascinating. I was interested in the psychology of the seance room.
And so, what did you learn about the psychology of the seance room? What were the the levers that people were pushing to convince the people in the room that there was a
First of all, it's actually in a totally dark room. You've got no context. So you've got a luminous object, and it's very hard to tell whether it's moving, because you can't see the table, you can't see the surroundings. So if your eyes move a little bit or your head moves, often it looks like the object is moving. And the Victorian fake mediums knew about that, and that coupled with some verbal suggestion, means that you can get some quite big effects. So we would suggest objects were moving, everyone should focus on them, and then lo and behold, around about 40% of people would report movements after the sounds, but we'd done nothing at all other than suggested it. So suggestion really matters, and belief matters. So when you go and see a magician, you know you're going to be fooled. You don't sort of have an open mind in that sense, and so the tricks have to be pretty good. When you go and see a medium or a psychic, you want it to be true. And so you kind of cut them quite a lot of slack. And so the tricks are nowhere near as good, but they have a bigger impact because you're just not looking for a trick. Mm. You know, in the same way as, you know, you don't go to your doctor and kind of go, what's the symptoms? You go, well, you know, you tell me, I'm going to sit here and not tell you anything. The two of you work together to create a diagnosis. And that's very similar to going to a psychic. You want it to be true. The two of you work together. And in some ways, of the psychic, the sitter, the person going, does more of the work than the psychic. In a sense, they should be charging the psychic for the session.
And so you're up there in a very haunted part of the country. Can you give me a definitive answer as to whether ghosts exist then?
I think I can, and I don't think they do. I know, I'm so sorry. I've worked in many haunted, allegedly haunted places.
I was hoping for the unexpected answer there.
Turns out there's
no, sorry.
Yeah, that'd be great, wouldn't it? So I worked in Hampton Court Palace, which is allegedly haunted, which was great. We're the first Ghostbusters, as it were, to be called into a royal palace. Fantastic.
That's a good way to get free rent.
Yes. We stayed there for 10 days. It was amazing. You have a part of the palace called the Haunted Gallery, which the first clue is in the title. People have had lots of weird experiences there. So we did some experiments there. And then with the underground vaults in Edinburgh, which allegedly haunted, we did experiments there. And what we saw in each case was that actually there is something to the claim that people do have weird experiences in these places, even if they don't know the reputation of them. My guess is that those are environmentally driven. So one hypothesis is about ultrasound, very low frequency sound waves, which cars can produce and air conditioning systems can produce, and they kind of make you feel very uneasy, but you can't hear them. And it's possible that haunted locations have a large amount of that. So we looked at that and did experiments into that. So yeah, unfortunately, I'm not a big believer in ghosts. I'm sorry.
Hi, sorry, I'm just going to interrupt for just a second to tell you about a new subscription offer we've got going for BBC Science Focus magazine. It's 6 issues for £9.99, it's great value, and it comes straight to your door, which is ideal in these strange times. Don't miss out because we've got some great issues coming up. We're soon going to be digging into the science of dogs, and we're going to be finding out whether life could have started around black holes. And we've even got a behind-the-scenes feature coming up about the UK's next moon mission. To get the offer, head to www.buysubscriptions.com/science-focus-spring-podcast-offer. Anyway, back to the show. And you've also, in the last bit of your paranormal experience, I suppose, you've looked into ESP, extrasensory perception, is that?
That's right.
Sorry, just a sudden, what does ESP stand for? my memory
I'm sending
failing
it to you now.
I got it. Magic. Now I remember, so that's right. So you've studied that. And interestingly, it's got an interesting history, I suppose, because I suppose of most paranormal things, there was a fair bit of scientific weight behind it. I suppose there was a general consensus for a while that there might be something to it.
Yeah.
What did you find in your?
It is a really interesting literature, and a much better literature than most skeptics would think. So yeah, it goes back all the way to Victorian scientists doing these studies. I was always very skeptical of it. And I thought it was due to, you say extrasensory perception. The other joke is error someplace is the other gag that some people use. I thought it was down to errors. And so I did some research into that, then drifted away from it. And then a psychologist and parapsychologist called Daryl Bem did some research where participants in his study seemed to be able to see into the future. So I tried to replicate those studies and couldn't replicate them. And then we couldn't publish those null replications because journals like to carry positive findings. So we struggled to replicate them, but eventually, struggled to publish, but eventually we did. And then because of Darrell's kind of high profile studies, other psychologists started to look at his methods and criticize them and go, hold on a second, you're sort of doing lots of analyses there and you've got lots of hypotheses you're not telling us about and so on and so forth. I think some of those criticisms are true. And then other psychologists went, hold on a second, that may be true of parapsychology, but it's also true of psychology. And in psychology, it's very difficult to publish replications that didn't work out. So it's all right us criticizing parapsychology, but what about psychology? And that's led to what's now known as the replication crisis, that lots of psychological findings don't replicate, and lots of these errors that parapsychologists are making, psychologists are making too. So weirdly, parapsychology has changed certainly the face of psychology and possibly science, but in ways it didn't anticipate, not because it's found a new psychic force, but because methodologically it's exposed flaws that were present in lots of psychology experiments.
I didn't realise that was where the replication crisis had sort of, part of it had begun.
Absolutely, yeah. And so now that's led to what's called registered reports, which is scientists and psychologists in particular have to register their experiment beforehand and what analyses they're going to carry out in order to prevent some of these errors. Now, parapsychologists have been doing that a very long time because they realised that that was a problem very early on. But it's only really in the last couple of years that's come into psychology. So this fringe area has had a massive impact on the mainstream.
Okay. So I want to move on now to something you've talked about before, which is sort of your latest focus of interest with the big, obviously, anniversary of the Apollo moon landings having just passed. Mm. What, you know, I think you've hinted at it, but, you know, there is a link. I didn't see it, actually, until, we started talking, that the link between the moon landings and Apollo and your other sort of fields of study. Can you talk to me about the relationship there between those two?
I actually hadn't realised that link either. Most recently I've been writing sort of self-development-y, evidence-based, but still self-development stuff. And so I was talking to a friend of mine, Helen Keane, who's a comedian, but also a sort of huge Apollo and space fan. And this was a few years ago. And we're talking about all the technology that's come from the moon landings. And I said, and it's just a comment off the top of my head. I said, well, what about the mental technology, the mindset that got us onto the moon? And she said, well, I don't think anyone's really done very much on that. But you should contact Craig, who's a friend of hers, another sort of space fan, because over the years, and he lives in Wales, over the years, he's befriended the Apollo mission controllers, the people who sat at the heart of the moon landings. So I contacted Craig. He put me in touch with all the mission controllers. And they hadn't really been interviewed about the mindset. And as I started to conduct those interviews, I realized this very strong linkage with magic and with the paranormal in that sense, in that, boy, was it an impossible dream. It was ridiculous in 62 to think you're going to put a person on the moon when you've only got a rocket that's going, you know, a few inches off the ground at best. And so I looked at the Kennedy archives, and it's astonishing. You know, scientists are saying to him, well, we could perhaps put a satellite up. And he's going, think bigger. We might be able to put a space station up. Think bigger. Might be able to get a rocket to the moon. Think bigger. We might be able to get a person on the moon and back again. And then he says, by the end of the decade. And so what do you do when you're confronted with the impossible? And that's what the book is about. It's about the Apollo mindset. And part of it is they brought in, as I said before, people who were so young, they didn't know that it couldn't be done. They never told them how hard it was. And they selected on passion. So those were often the mission controllers from rural America, first in their families to go to college, but boy, were they passionate. I spoke to the recruitment officer, and he said, if they came in with fire in their eyes, and he said, I made the office quite hard to find so that anyone who found it really wanted to be there. He said, if they had fire in their eyes, they started. And if that, I couldn't sense that fire, they didn't. And it's an astonishing story of how, in about 7 years, you accomplish the impossible.
That's really interesting because it's something that I suppose it's quite, you know, fire in their eyes is something that I imagine we could all recognise, but would be pretty hard to put into a, you know, a psychological test of the sort that you, you know, that you typically find in these really, you know, when companies like Cisco or IBM recruit and they have these psychometric tests. That's the word I was looking for. Is that true?
I think there's been a movement away from some of that sort of testing, where that notion of skills based testing, and I think now there's that notion of kind of character. That when I spoke to the mission controllers, it was so odd. I trusted them. I absolutely trusted them within seconds of speaking. It's a very strange thing to try and explain, but you just go, if my life was on the line, I'd want you looking after me. I trust you. And I think that was there. They had a huge integrity and passion. And often, because they're from a farming background, they were used to working in a team. So they weren't egotists. They use the we word throughout the interview. They never use I. We did this. Oh, you should speak to so-and-so. They did an amazing job. It was never about them. It was always about the team. And they were used to problem solving with what they had. They did sort of fantastic in terms of agility and innovation. So I think all those things, it sort of saddens me. I think social media is making us very I-centered. We want to tell the world how wonderful we are, and we get very down because we look at other people on social media and they seem to be even more wonderful than we are, even though we know we're lying on social media, and I assume they are as well. So I think we've lost the we-ness that a lot of people say, I want to be a celebrity, instead of I want to do something which is meaningful, which will last past my lifetime, that will be a legacy that isn't about me. It's doing something meaningful and kind for others. And the mission controllers had that mindset massively.
And suppose this is probably, you know, my penultimate question, but it seems clear now, but I'll ask it anyway. Would you say that the impossible is something that's sort of threaded through your work thus far?
Absolutely. I mean, in different ways. So magicians fabricate it. I think the paranormalists claim it's true when it isn't, and the Apollo folks do it for real. But what you have underlying that is still that notion of openness each time to something which should not be true but turns out or appears to be. And as humans, you think, isn't that phenomenal? In our heads, we can simulate and model an event which is completely outside of our understanding. And I think the upside of that is occasionally that impossible event turns out to be possible. And it's those very special moments that push forward technology, or, you know, whatever it is, medicine or science. When somebody comes along and goes, I know everyone is telling me this is impossible. Actually, I think I can do it. And here's the evidence. And we all go, oh, my goodness. And then we all follow along that way. So, yeah, I think it is a theme that sat below there.
If you've enjoyed this episode and our new series, please do subscribe. And if you can spare a minute, leave a review. It lets us know you're enjoying the format, and you can even let us know what topic you want us to tackle next. Of course, for more guides to the big ideas in science and technology, head over to our website, sciencefocus.com. Or better yet, sign up to our brilliant newsletter at sciencefocus.com/newsletter.
Thank you for listening to the Science Focus podcast from the BBC Science Focus magazine team. We're the UK's best-selling science and technology monthly, available in print and in several digital formats throughout the world. Find out more at sciencefocus.com or look out for us in your app store.